I am going to start the meeting because we're going to have to end early. And so for people who are here on time, you're going to be rewarded with the announcements, and the others can just flounder. And the announcements are, there is no committee tomorrow because it's our expectation that all the working groups will at least meet and get organized. And you have in your packet the working groups and who is on them. And if there's any members of the audience who would like to know what working groups people are on so they can check with those legislators, there are copies of these. Are they in the back of the room? Is that where they are? In the back of the room and on the green sheets. But I'll just read off what they are so that people can know. We have one group looking at integration revenue, and that's headed up by Representatives Newton and Brown, and they're going to be looking at the legislative auditor's report and also the financing and try to come to recommendations that we actually can act on this year. Charter school reform is headed up by Representative Slocum for both policy and finance committees. Mandate reduction is Representative Tilbury and Benson, and it, of course, will just be Representative Tilbury till Representative Benson gets back. That's the largest committee that most legislators were interested in. The shared services and efficiencies, Representative Swale, another large committee, and the permanent school trust fund, Representative Dietrich. So, and Representative Mariani and I will be ex officio members of all the committees, and when they are meeting and where will be kept in my office, even though arrangements will be made by the lead legislators' staff. So, but if you want to know when any of them are meeting or where, then you can check with my office. We will be dismissing at about a little before 4 because we have the early childhood education summit in the House chamber that we hope everybody will be able to go to because that's a very important initiative. We now do have a quorum, so Representative Ward, would you move the minutes, please?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes for January 27th, 2009.
Representative Ward moves the minutes of January 27th. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. We are now going to be talking about the accounting shifts that we kind of figured we're going to be in the governor's budget. So we've had this scheduled since before we got his budget, and yes, indeedy, there they were. And so we figured members on this committee, where we have to deal with the fallout of those sorts of tactics, should be informed about them. And I always need a refresher course, so I'm guessing that all the returning members do, and then the new members for sure do. And we're going to start out with our own Greg Crow, who will give us the 101 on accounting shifts. And then we have three different types of districts that are going to be presenting to tell us about what it means to them to have accounting shifts. We have Peggy Ingerson from Minneapolis, not the largest district, but a large district. And we have, and she's also, by the way, going to broaden the discussion and kind of use also her previous hat as a state finance commissioner and tell us even a bigger, broader picture than just Minneapolis. Then Dennis Peterson, who's the superintendent of Minnetonka, and Joe Brown, the superintendent of Grand Meadow. So we have urban, suburban, and greater Minnesota. But first we'll start out with Mr. Crow. Mr. Crow.
Okay. Even blind squirrel finds a nut every day, and we got the computer working. I'm just going to go very quickly through kind of a quick primer of a shift. I'm going to do some quick terms. You've got the PowerPoint handout. There's only one spot that that I really wanted the PowerPoint for, to try and give you a visual look at what's happening, and there's a color slide that I put into your packets that that'll go along with that. So there's some jargon that we should all understand when we're talking about shifts, just to kind of make it easier for you to get a sense of what's happening. So the first piece of jargon is an entitlement. In education, an entitlement is a little different than you might hear it in human services. Basically, it means the amount of revenue that's needed to fund the formula. So for the basic formula, $5,124 times the number of kids is the entitlement for that year. Very, very, very straightforward. What's not as straightforward is that we don't always appropriate the entitlement. And that's why we use the 90-10 shift. So the appropriation then, that piece of jargon, is the amount of state aid that's appropriated in a fiscal year for a formula, and it's not usually the same as the entitlement because of that, the shifting that we do. The other thing you should keep in mind as we're talking about this, the term current year. Current year simply means the year we're in. It may seem straightforward, but we actually fund, in a given year, we actually fund the current year as well as the prior year when we make an appropriation.
Mr. Smoke, just a minute here. Somebody's got their cell phone on, and we need to have those off because they do, in this room, affect the sound. Thank you. Mr. Crow.
So the current year, we have a partial payment in the current year. You don't want to be the person that stands up and walks away.
Whatever those persons wanted this year out of this committee.
The current year payment is made in the current year. The final payment is actually made in the year after the current year. So basically we have a makeup payment, you might hear us call it. We make 27 payments over the course of the year. Basically every other week the payments are made to school districts. Some of them are made in the current year. Some of them are made as the final payment, and there's actually multiple final payments in the next fiscal year. Now a couple of accounting terms, basic accounting terms that will help you understand why we shift and how we save money shifting. Accrual accounting is when revenues and expenditures are counted when the obligation is created, and that's what school districts use. In other words, if I'm supposed to give you $5, in accrual accounting, you get to count that $5 as money in your pocket, even though I may not have given it to you yet. On the state side, we use what's called cost accounting. That is, the revenues and the expenditures are counted in the year that the money actually appears or is paid. So in that example, if I owe you $5, you don't get to count it as $5 until I give it to you under a cost accounting system. And the state uses this system, the school districts use accrual accounting, and that difference actually in accounting system, or in accounting methods, is why there's savings when we do shift. So, school aid payments. How do we make payments? First, we calculate an entitlement. Basically, I want to walk you through how we make these payments or how these things are done so that you can understand how they're impacted when we do a shift. So we calculate the entitlement. Again, the example, $5,124 per pupil. If there's 1,000 or pupils, then that means the entitlement is $5,124. Then we write an appropriation, and we use the aid payment percentages to assign part of that appropriation to the different fiscal years. So when we talk about a 90-10 split, that means we take 90% of that $5,124 and put it in the current year, and 10% and appropriate it in the subsequent fiscal year. So, for example, $1 million entitlement gets 90% appropriated in the current fiscal year, and 10% appropriated in the next fiscal year. So if it was a one-time entitlement, you'd actually see two appropriations. So a one-time entitlement in fiscal 10 for $1 million would be appropriated $900,000 in fiscal 10 and a $100,000 in fiscal 11. We do payment shifts because, for the most part, we're estimating data that we're calculating these shifts, that we're calculating the entitlement on. We might be estimating the number of pupils, property value, estimated usage of a program. So by having that final payment in the next fiscal year, that payment can be adjusted before it's paid out so that everyone ends up with what they were entitled to get, so that we aren't going back and catching up with people we underpaid, or taking money back from school districts if we overpay them. So because of these adjustments in forecast information, those final payments actually don't end up being exactly 10% in all cases. And you know, the number of pupils is different. A district might overestimate its number of pupils, so when we figure that out, they don't get quite 10%, or they might underestimate the number of pupils, so we give them a little more than 10% because our original calculations of what was due to them were too low. So what happens when we change the payment shift? Usually when we're changing the payment shift to save the state money, you can go ahead and interrupt at any time.
I'm going to tell you, we're going to stop you about 3:10 if we can.
Okay.
So Representative Swales and then Representative Detmer.
Okay.
Well, this may be covered later. But yesterday Dr. Melcher was talking about the fact that you really should do shifts no more than, was it twice that he said, or what happens? I was going to wait, and I think I will wait, until we get done with school aid payments, and then we'll have any questions that have to do with school aid payments. Then we'll do the levy referendum shift, recognition shift, and any questions that have to do with that. And then if we have time, we'll take the general questions, but those general questions could be asked any time during the hearing, and we want to make sure we get all these others heard from. So, Representative Detmer, is yours on the school aid payment shift?
Yep.
And if it is, we'll wait till the end of this section. But is it? Is it general or on the payment school aid payment shift?
It'd be dealing with the school aid
payment. Okay, we'll take you when he finishes this section then. Mr. Crow.
Okay. So when we change the shift from 90-10, as it is under current law, to 80-20, for example, what happens then is that we're shifting the amount of money the state is paying out of the current year and into a subsequent fiscal year. So, in this example, we're talking about the $1 million entitlement. When we go from a 90-10 to an 80-20 split, we change to paying 80% in the current year, or $800,000, and 20% in the subsequent year, or $200,000. So, just kind of, if the state did annual budgeting, you can see how the state is shifting funds from a current obligation to a future obligation and saving a little bit of money. Schools, the reason it's important that we mention the kind of accounting system is that schools count all of that revenue as revenue for the current year, even though it might get paid in a subsequent year, because they know that that money is coming. Okay, so that we covered that there. So now I wanted to use this chart and put it up on the screen, because I'm going to kind of introduce different things at different times to try and show you how the funding system works and try and tie some of these years together, because it's kind of confusing. So under current law, we have a 90-10 payment split. So in fiscal 2009, for example, 90% is from the current year, and that's the light red, or the pink color on the 90%, and then there's gray at the top on the 10% that's from fiscal 2009. So all the colors tie together to show you the entitlement. So the pink goes with the dark red in fiscal 10. That's 100% of the entitlement, the 90 plus the 10. Then the light blue and the dark blue, 90 plus 10. And again, the light green and the dark green, 90 plus 10. So you can see that each year we're paying 100%, but we're not paying 100% for the current year's entitlement. We're paying 90% of the current year's entitlement, and then the next year we're picking up an additional, the final 10%. So now let's convert to 80-20, and I'm just going to do it for example purposes for fiscal years 2010 and 2011. So the first thing we do is that light blue bar goes down to 80%, because we're covering 80% of the entitlement in the current year. Well, then what happens? We don't fund 10%, we don't fund 20% that year, because we're picking up that red piece, which is the last part of the entitlement from the previous year. So we're picking up 10% that ties back to the 90 from fiscal 2009. So this difference between the total in the bar of 90% and 100% of an entitlement is the amount of savings to the state that year. So then the next year, we're still paying the 80%, but that year we pick up 20% from the previous year, because that 80% bar, obviously, is less than 90, so there's 20 left to pick up in the blue year, which is the 2010 entitlement amount. So that blue ties with the next blue, and you can see that we're back to paying 100% of an entitlement. Now, we're not paying 100%, we're paying 80% from the current year and 20% from the previous year. Now let's presume we convert back to a 90-10 schedule in 2012. So what happens is, then we pay a current year entitlement of 90% in 2012, but we have to pick up the 20% from the green year, from the entitlement from 2011. So then that amount exceeds 100%, and this is the cost to the state to repay that shift. And as you can see in the example, there aren't dollar amounts, but if the dollar amount is flat over time, that dollar amount to repay exactly equals the amount that we saved in 2010 when we shifted from 90-10 to 80-20. So that's the end of payment shifts, and we can talk about that a little bit more before. And I'll just talk specifically about the governor's proposal at the end and how much he saves.
Representative Detmer.
I think this relates to it. How often are the student numbers counted during the school year?
Mr. Crow.
We do updated counts for the forecast, and I think districts can basically report whenever they want, but the forecast only changes in November and February. The payments, Tim, do you know if the payments get adjusted?
Mr. Stump.
As they're paying them out?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, yes, throughout the year as the school district adjusts its pupil counts, their payments will be automatically adjusted. There's some timelines the department uses for that, but essentially if the school district predicts 1,000 kids in November and realizes in December that they have 1,200 kids they're serving, they change their counts with the department, and the payment schedule is affected pretty immediately thereafter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't even ask you how they do that, but it must be a complicated done by computer, I am assuming. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crow, you said something, I don't think you meant to say this, but doesn't it actually cost more to buy back the shift than it does originally?
Mr. Crow.
Representative Garofalo, no. The amount you save is always equal to the amount that you're paying back. What you've seen over time, and we'll look at it, I have a chart of some of the recent shifts. We always say there's one-time savings when we institute a shift, and that's what we have to pay back. But in reality, we get annual savings for making that shift if the aid entitlement is growing. So, in other words, we get a big shift because we initially shift the entire amount of aid payments that the state is making that qualify for the shift. Then the next year, that aid amount is higher, and we shift, and we're also shifting that, but now we're shifting a slightly higher number. So on the margin, the difference between the entitlements from one year to the next, we get a little bit of shift savings from that year to the next. So in the governor's proposal, they're carrying about $670-$680 million of shift savings in fiscal 10. But then if you look at fiscal 11, they're carrying another $15 million. So there's, which is significant, but relative to the 670, it looks like the 670 is one time. But as that entitlement grows, or on the levy side, if the levy grows, there are additional shift savings every year, and the aggregate of all those savings equal the amount that you pay back.
Madam Chair, Mr. Cook, that may be true in a theoretical sense. However, when we budget for the upcoming fiscal year, beginning on July 1, imagine a hypothetical, we're on an 80-20 shift. Very rarely would we ever say, well, we're going to pay back the shift, but we're not going to put any money on the formula. So if we're going to be adding money to the formula, we're not going to realize any shift savings, so we add money to the formula. Not only do we have to buy back the shift that we just added, we also have to buy back the shift from before. So in a practical sense, when we're putting money in the formula, if we're trying to pay back the shift at the same time, it does cost more money, right?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, as the entitlement grows, you get more savings. So even if you add spending, you actually... it costs less to create that funding program because you're shifting some of the cost of it into future years. So the aggregate of all of the savings always equals the cost to pay it back. It's a zero-sum situation.
But Representative Garofalo, if you are adding to the formula and you're not paying back the shift, you're going to keep getting a bigger and bigger bill. So I think that's maybe what you're after. It's a quagmire, no matter how you look at it.
Right.
Representative Garofalo.
That's the point. But the point is that... if you don't shift the money forward, right,
yeah,
you don't get any savings.
Correct.
So you have to pay for it now. So if you have, okay, when you add money to the formula in the upcoming fiscal year, mm-hmm. if you never shift it forward, right, you don't get any savings. But you still have to pay for it now.
Right. But
oh, boy, you're glazing over. I'm
that's Mr. Crow. You can answer him very shortly, and then
we always apply the same shift to new appropriations that are shifted that we have in current law. So wouldn't, if we add money, if whether we do it through a new program or through growth in existing entitlements, that will create shift savings that will then have to be paid off. So, and yes, the amount we get the first year is, in for all practical purposes, we save less than we have to pay off, but it's not because of interest or anything funny like that. It's because we aggregate savings over time that are a lot smaller than the first year.
This segment I wanted to end in 2 minutes, and we probably can't, so let's really try to end it in by 3:15, and so I'm not going to have any questions till Mr. Crow concludes, and then hopefully we will have some time, though, for a couple questions.
Okay, so the payment shift is one type of shift. The other type is the levy shift. Property taxpayers make their payments in May and October. The money is given to the schools for the fiscal year beginning July 1st of that calendar year. So the May and October 2009 payments that will be made this year are revenue for fiscal year 2010. So they collect the first payment right before the fiscal year starts, and they collect the second payment a few months after the fiscal year has begun. When we institute a levy recognition shift, what's happening is we're telling districts, instead of counting them part of their May payment as revenue for the next fiscal year, they have to count it for the one that's just about to end. So, so for example, for fiscal year, a recognition shift for fiscal 2009 would require some districts to take some of their May 2009 revenue and count it as revenue for the year that ends in the summer of 2009. This saves money for the state because districts are collecting more levy revenue than they would have otherwise for that given fiscal year, and the state has a particular entitlement and so won't pay aid because it's basically been offset by local levy. So if a district's entitlement for a year is $1 million, they can't get more than $1 million for that year. So if they were a 50% aid, 50% levy district, and they collected $500,000 worth of levy, and then the state said, you have to recognize half of next year's levy as revenue for this year, they'd apply another $250,000 worth of levy toward this year's revenue. So the state, rather than paying them that $500,000 that they were owed, says we're only going to get you up to $1 million and pays $250,000, which saves the state money till the next year. Now, the school district then collects that money to offset the money that they would have moved from May into to the next fiscal year, and that goes on and on until the state chooses to pay off the levy. And when the state does choose to pay it off, extra aid is paid because there's less levy to recognize than they had in the year before because they're moving some of their May payment from the current fiscal year back into the fiscal year it was originally supposed to be applied to. Some constraints, debt levies are not shiftable. Some levies are already 100% forward shifted, so those aren't shiftable. And effectively, you've got about a 50% cap on levy because of the timing of the property tax payments. Then there's a table in there of recent shifts. You can see if you add those shift, those one-time shift revenue savings in 2002, 3, and 4, you get a total of about $900 million in savings. And then if you look at the 5 years where we had to pay off those shifts, it cost about $1 billion to pay those shifts off. So that $100 million difference isn't that it costs more because of interest or something, it's just that there was also $100 million of savings during those fiscal years as we progressed with higher levies and higher aid entitlements. And I'm just going to skim over this. You can see basically the aid payment shift is linear. Every percent generates the same dollar amount of savings to the aid. On the levy side, since some of the referendum levies are already partially shifted, it's not linear. We get less savings at a lower shift percentage and more savings at a higher shift percentage. And then the governor proposed going to 80-20 on the shift, which is $686 million. I think what Mr. Melcher mentioned yesterday was that he was comfortable going to 80%, but not necessarily beyond that. And then the governor had a 48.6% property tax shift, which is the same as what was instituted in 03, with about $600 million of savings.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. And I think, Representative Wales, if that didn't just answer your question, you should ask it again.
It did.
It did. Okay.
And if I need a tutorial, Tom Melcher is my constituent.
You have a very good constituent for a tutorial. And members, if you have a chance, I think this year would be the year, if you're ever going to read Mr. Crow's really good, excellent summary of what he just said with even more explanation. It's crystal clear. You will understand shift if you read this. And I really encourage every member to do that, because we do need to understand shift. We have this idea that I talked with Senator Stump last night, and he said every time he walks down the halls of the Senate, his colleagues are kicking him because education came out unscathed in the governor's budget. But if you would read this and understand shift and talk to, if not Mr. Crow or Dr. Melcher, Representative Garofalo, you will know that education did not come out unscathed by having a $1.3 billion taking from us. It's borrowed. We have to pay it back, and we're going to hear from school districts on, you know, what does that mean for their local budgets. And I'll tell you, I hate shift. It will delay our funding of things like the new Minnesota Miracle. It will flatline schools for quite a while, I think, because it means that whenever we get money, we have to keep taking huge hunks of it to pay this back. And it looks like we got money, but we did not. But when push comes to shove, school districts would rather have shifts than to actually be cut. And so that complicates their message to us, I believe. Any other questions for Mr. Crow? Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Crow, Madam Chair, Mr. Crow, bottom of page 6, you have the 2004 law listed as a subnote there about we have to, any surplus dollars, fill up the budget reserve, I think it's budget reserve cash flow, and then we start paying off the property tax recognition shift. Is that still in statute, or is that money going to the 21st Century Mineral Fund now?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, no, that is still in law, and it would require, as you mentioned, a cash flow account, which still remains at $350 million, but also budget reserve restored, which was depleted during the unallotment process. So that would be the next thing to get money out of a forecast, if there was a forecast surplus, and then it goes to pay off the payment shift and then the property tax shift.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Just that, because there was a tax bill where, I wasn't kidding about that, I was serious, the 21st Century Mineral Fund is where it went. Is that after the shift? Is that after the shifts are paid off? Or?
I don't see a sub 5. I printed it out, but I think I left it in my office. I didn't know that they'd actually adopted that, so I'll do some quick follow-up. I think, Tim.
And Representative Rockwell, Mr. Strom is looking, makes a good point, though, because that shift and the borrowing and so forth doesn't mean it just benefits schools. Other budgets are looking. Mr. Strom.
And, Madam Chair, if I could make one last point that
Mr.
I forgot, but I did want to make that'll help you transition to the districts, is that even though the accounting allows them to count that as revenue, it is not without cost to school districts to make these shifts. Doing these kind of shifts basically delays when they get their money, and so it can create cash flow issues for districts. And there are two types of costs for them. If they have reserves, there's an interest cost to them because they lose the interest and they have to spend it to maintain their cash flow. If they don't have reserves, then they have to borrow, and obviously we have an ability for districts to borrow money called aid anticipation that they can borrow basically on the idea or on the, you know, on the fact that they're going to get money, but that has an interest cost to them. It's a loan.
Representative Demmer, did you have your hand up, or was I? You didn't. Representative Anzels, and then we'll go on to Ms. Ingus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the implications to local boards of education on the borrowing problem and the cash flow problem and the reserve problem during the period of the shift. My question is, historically speaking, do we have any information on what implications these shifts have had on local boards' decisions to raise property taxes during the period of the shift? And in effect, do shifts affect low property wealth districts in different ways than they do silk stocking districts?
Mr. Crowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Enzo, I don't have any information about what has happened in the past, and I think they affect districts that have less. I think they affect districts that have lower fund balances much differently than they do other districts. And in fact, the last time we had a shift, and in the governor's budget proposal, there's a provision that allows districts in statutory operating debt to apply not to be shifted, basically, and ask and get their money, continue to receive their money on the current payment schedule. And in 2003, when we initially did this, we had about I believe it was 13 districts applying for that, and or 30 districts and getting $11 million, not getting $11 million, but we had created a loan fund that was tapped to about $11 million of money that was the state was loaning itself, basically, to, it was a mechanism to show the cost of not being able to shift for those districts. But yeah, we tried and account for the fact that they have a much lower ability to
do. And I think Representative, as we bring the districts up, you'll see the differences on how they like these things. Let's start with Ms. Ingeson. Welcome to the committee, and appreciate very much both being here for Minneapolis as the Chief Financial Officer, but also with your broader hat, we hope to hear some words of wisdom. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Peggy Ingeson. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I formerly served in a couple of different capacities here as State Finance Commissioner as well as State Budget Director for a number of years prior to that, and I appreciate the, your staff, Madam Chair, giving a great background piece on this, because shifts, I think people talk about the fact that school payment shifts have been used as a tool in budget balancing for a number of years, and I just wanted to offer a little bit of perspective. I want to be sure to be clear that I'm not commenting on the governor's budget recommendations, but just trying to provide a little perspective here, because I would hate to have any of the responsibility that the current finance or Minnesota management and budget staff have right now, and I definitely have my hands full at the Minneapolis Public School District, so I'm really not trying to second guess or do anyone else's job. But in just offering a little bit of perspective on this, because I think that as you mentioned, Madam Chair, sometimes people think of school payment shifts as a painless, easy way to balance the budget. And in the governor's recommendations, I think we're talking about $1.3 billion. And I just want to provide the perspective about how others view us. And, you know, as we were in some of my prior positions, as we talked to rating agencies, for example, it's one of the things that governments can do is control when payments are received, when revenues are collected, when payments are made. People in businesses go into the marketplace and do borrowing based on a business cycle, but when people are going into the marketplace borrowing as a public entity, it's an indication, because of the fact that we control receipts and payments, that it's an indication of a lack of discipline in the process. And so, in fact, at the Minneapolis Public Schools, there hasn't been any short-term borrowing. I think the last year was 2005-2006, and it's pretty directly, the lack of borrowing is pretty directly related to when the state brought back the school payment shift, and I kind of proud of the fact that I was Commissioner of Finance when those payments shifts were brought back. And
you should be proud of that.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think, in fact, you identified some of the costs to districts. It's, I think in Minneapolis we have several years ago now, but the borrowing costs were in the neighborhood of $2.5 million. And that's a lot of teachers. And in fact, the other thing about the school payment system, I guess, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I can specifically answer some of the questions that your staff asked me to address about the number of districts that are forced into borrowing because of the shifts and the districts that currently borrow. And I just saw from...
What, excuse me. We want to, because we have to end at about 5 to 4, we would like to have you go until 3:30 or a little bit after, and then 10 minutes for each of the others as well. So, you know, you don't have to answer those questions.
Okay, good.
If you want, we'll let you use your time however you would like.
Okay.
But we would
great.
Like to be able to ask a couple questions at the end.
Okay, good. I'll just take another minute or so I can get to your questions. But, Madam Chair, I indicated that this is a little bit of a an indication to outsiders that there's a lack of discipline in the process when shifts are used. And I also want to say that as much as we are struggling with a shortfall for the coming school year of $28 million at the Minneapolis district, and it's a little over 5% of our operating budget, we're really trying to look at the sustainability of the school district financial situation, really trying to force the leadership and the board into making the tough decisions that need to be made. And to some extent, when you know when we have payment shifts, it leads people to think that, well, either the school district didn't get cut, why do we have to make some of these tough decisions? And so I think that there's a little bit of the what are the expectations that people have, and they see, you know, just try to explain to somebody how the state can save $1.3 billion and nobody's really getting cut. So I think it's a little difficult for us in the whole trying to have some integrity and be clear about the things that we know we need to do and face some of these issues straight up. So
I think that we'll have the same problem.
Thank you. I'll answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions. Representative Dabney, you had a question for the last one. Maybe you want to ask it of Ms. Ingerson, if you can remember what it was.
Well, I actually can because I scribbled little incomprehensible notes here. and pleasure. Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. The two questions I had for Mr. Crowe that given Ms. Ingerson's background, she may be able to help with is, do we track or do school districts report their fund balances to the state, so could we look at the impact of previous shifts on school district fund balances? And I'm particularly thinking in light of the budget trends study group that, as I heard their report, a big thrust of their recommendations was everybody needs to have more robust fund balances than they currently do. That's question one. And question two, and again, Ms. Anderson, if you can, the districts report the cost of their short-term borrowing. So again, we could do have the ability to look back in time and see what impact shifts have had on school district budgets in the ebb and flow of shifts.
Ms. Ingerson.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, school districts report on their fund balances, and I'm glad that you pointed out that it's important for entities. I clearly think that it is a sign of prudent fiscal management, especially in districts like Minneapolis, where we have a great deal of risk in our enrollment projections and all kinds of other things, because, in fact, our fund balance has grown. And it was really recklessly low for a time, and we feel like we have to rationalize and, I guess, justify the fund balances. But yes, districts do report on their fund balances, and you can see, you can look and see the comparisons of district fund balances across lines. Now, there are many different kinds of things that impact a district fund balance and many reasons why districts increase their fund balances or decrease their fund balances and use them. And in fact, we had, as I mentioned, we have increased the fund balance at the Minneapolis district and have been recognized by the rating agencies as good news in spite of the fact that there are a lot of others that think that we should be using it up. The cost of short-term borrowing, I'm not really sure if that is very specifically identified as the cost. I think that there are interest earnings and interest expense that is reported, but I don't know. There are a number of reasons. You are probably well aware of the fact that the Minneapolis district has borrowed for pension obligations in the past as well. So I don't know if all of those interest expenses are merged together or if there's a way to identify the short-term borrowing specifically. I might just add one more thing to quite a few years ago, like maybe 25 years ago, I think, when I was actually working in the Senate, worked with some staff in the House, the Senate, and with some folks in the Department of Finance at the time to really look at what was the impact of the, at the time it was a school property tax recognition shift, and what was the impact on school districts. And there wasn't as much concern about the shift at that point in time, because we discovered that, in fact, districts were making some money out of this for arbitrage because they could borrow at a very low tax-exempt rate and invest at higher rates. I don't think that there's a marketplace like that, the marketplace such as that does not exist right now. So there's it's just a much less favorable time to even be borrowing, let alone borrowing for operating expenses.
Ms. Ingerson, if you were still advising a governor and we were trying to figure out shifts, taxes, cuts, reorganization, which of course is all of the things we're looking at this year, what role would shifts play in your recommendation?
Madam Chair, that's a put me on the spot question, because like I say, I really have my hands full, and I don't want that job on top of it.
I would say your good sense and your intelligence.
I appreciate that. I would say that shifts should definitely be used as a last resort, because as I said, they're definitely an indication of a lack of discipline in the process, and I think it's really important for us to think about long-term sustainability and look at, from a state perspective as well as school districts, what is it that, where do we need to get to in the long term to make sure we have a sustainable financial system for whatever entity.
Last resort, not in the first cut. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first a comment, Ms. Ingerson, the arbitrage thing, when I was on the school board back in the 90s, we did that routinely and quite openly. Superintendent talks quite openly about doing aid anticipation certificates and would show us how much money we made by doing that and then using that later. So it was interesting that you brought that up, so I was thinking about it. The second thing is, and this is more of a question / more information, when we talk about fund balances in schools, there isn't a fund balance. You can correct me here, but there are multiple fund balances, isn't that correct? And there's the unreserved balance that you have flexibility with, and then there are fund balances that are dedicated. And so I think just a caution that we need to be careful when we say what is the fund balance of a school, that if they get out, and sometimes you can get a blended number that doesn't necessarily accurately reflect what school districts are able to do, because some of those balances can be very high but untouchable if you don't use them in their areas, whereas unreserved, for example, that's low relative to the others can cause more of a problem than might otherwise show up, and you may comment on that or whatever. I don't know if that's a question or a comment, but big comment, and I appreciate it.
Ms. Ingerson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, you are absolutely correct. There's a lot of art to the reviewing and analyzing fund balance. There's the legally required reserves that school districts are required to have, and I might make a little pitch for flexibility in this time of difficulty with almost reserves, because sometimes we have reserves that are dedicated to particular purposes, and it you know, kind of ties our hands. Then there are reserves that are specifically earmarked by action of the board. So there's the legal reserves, and then there's designations that a board does, and it often is the information that's reported to the state just shows the total balance, and so it can be a little misleading. You have to look probably at individual financial statements to determine the balances in various funds. Yes, there's also the Government Finance Officers Association recommends fund balances in the range of 5 to 15%, but it really does depend largely on flow of funds. Certainly districts with large balances would be in better shape when there's a shift and have more tools to avoid the short-term operating borrowing. But in fact, there are other things to think about in analyzing reserves, like risk. We have a lot of risk in our district.
Okay, we have time for one more question if anyone has one. Okay, we might know if no one. Does anyone else have one that hasn't had one yet? Representative Garofalo.
I'm well behaved. thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Engelson, you had cryptically kind of mentioned this about a lack of discipline. I mean, I think you're qualified as a former commissioner. Do you believe that the excessive use of these ships puts our state in jeopardy of jeopardizing our bond rating? When the bonding houses look at this, do they care or not?
Ms. Engelson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say that it is it's always very difficult to find out specifically what kinds of things that affect ratings, because there's a whole number of factors that go into looking at this. And I would say that it by itself it might not impact ratings, but it certainly is a signal of the legislature's willingness to and the governor's willingness to face up to decisions versus putting things off. And I know, as I say this, because I have a lot of colleagues who say, well, you know, would you rather be cut than have a shift? And you know, obviously that's a you know, not a very balanced choice at all. But in fact, I think that there's you know, there are a number of things that could jeopardize ratings, and you know, certainly the overall financial situation that is similar across the country for folks. But it's really how what I found is that how governing bodies and entities respond to that economic situation that is the clearest indication from a rating agency about, you know, dedication to prudent financial management.
Yes. Madam Chair, I get it really quickly. I'll give you a more fair question because you kind of brought it up. If I had a choice of over in, you know, side A, raising revenue or cutting spending, and over here, and you don't have to choose one of them, just send one of those two, and over here is choice B where you're doing shifts, wouldn't you recommend side A versus side B? And you have to pick out which one of them. You don't get to select it, but wouldn't that be...
Ingerson, I think Representative Graffel has an answer he wants. So do you want the side A or side B?
I'm trying to help us. I think she was basically saying that, but I just wanted to reinforce
Representative Graffel, I'm actually on your side this time.
Yeah.
I'm glad we took time for your question. If it had been a bozo, you wouldn't have got a follow-up. Ms. Ingerson.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far.
Ms. Ingerson.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that the magnitude of the budget problem that is facing the state just indicates to me that we have to give consideration to everything that's out there. So I certainly think that there'll be a lot of discussion over the coming months about the tolerance level for tax increases, spending cuts, and shifts. And I just think that there has to be a balanced approach.
Thank you very, very much. Thanks for being here with us and spending some time.
Thank you.
Superintendent Peterson. And Dr. Peterson is from Minnetonka. Welcome, and please restate your name for the tape. And we now are going to be down to 10 minutes. We're going to end at 1:45, and we definitely want to have questions for you, and then we'll take Superintendent Brown at 10 too. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Peterson. I'm the superintendent of schools in Minnetonka. Paul Bourgeois, our chief financial officer, is with me. Paul has extensive background in finance issues in school districts, having been chief financial officer in Rochester as well as Minnetonka and years before that, and has also been in financial officer for a large corporation. My own background includes quite a bit of Minnesota legislation. I came here originally in 1974, and I was on the original UPARS committee that was appointed by Rudy Perpich in 76, so I've had that background. I've also been involved in extensive school finance legislation in Ohio, Missouri, Wyoming. I designed the entire school finance program in South Dakota in 1985. So, in a short version, we know how to run school districts and handle them very well financially. And I'm mostly frustrated with the whole conversation on shifts because it seems like a no-brainer to me. And I'm not speaking so much for the benefit that Minnetonka will get, because Minnetonka will get whatever benefit other districts get. But I would suggest to you that given the choice between cuts in education and shifts, there's no choice. Shifts absolutely make sense. And I would also suggest to you that I believe we've also lost the potential of revenue over the last 4 years that we could have had real money instead of buying back shifts if we wouldn't have passed the provision in the law in 2004, which I opposed at the time. I still think it's bad law that you have to buy back the shift, because the reality is if you're going to get a benefit for it, I'm not here to advocate for shifts for shift's sake, or to speak on behalf of the governor. I really didn't even know that the governor's proposal was going to be here. You suggested you did, but or suspected that. But if we're going to get some benefit for it, I'm definitely an advocate for the shifts. And I can say that if I'm superintendent in any of the 340-some districts in the state, that any one of us will benefit from the shifts. And I can sit down with each one of those superintendents and walk them through why their district will benefit. And if there's borrowing involved, you're borrowing on a small portion of the gain, if you will, if the gain is reasonable. I would suggest that the proposal that the governor has is really a cut in education, frankly, that's masked in the form of a shift. So there's a little bit more money for education, but it's not the full benefit that we would get if we got the money for the shift. In other words, if money for education was here and slid slightly by 10% over here, we would get a lot more money out of that than a 10% shift would accomplish. So my major points to you are that if we can either avoid cuts in order to we have a shift in order to avoid cuts, or if we can get some gain in order to accomplish that, a shift makes sense. And that you need to really seriously consider the statute 16A.152 subdivision 3 that provides for the need to unshift as soon as possible whenever it looks like you have money, because you don't need to. Once you've shifted, there's no reason why we can't stay at 80% of 1 year, 20% of the next, 80% and 20% and so on out. And the money is still on our accounting system showing up on our books. So I've spoken mainly about age shifts, but tax shifts really are a similar animal. If we can get some benefit from it, either avoiding cuts or getting actual money, they make sense. And as Mr. Crow has pointed out, we already have a shift in place, the 90-10. I would submit that we really don't need a 90-10, frankly, for most districts, but that's in statute and everybody thinks that's fine. But for some reason, if we do more of a shift than that, there are people that get excited about it. This is a unique tool for Minnesota. I don't know that all states have the dual accounting systems where they require school districts, and that's part of what we put in place in 76, to have one accounting system, the state uses another accounting system, and you take the benefit of this. But it is a tool. I know that if you...
Superintendent Peters, if you could finish up, because we're going to have... We would like to ask you questions.
Okay. I think I would love to have more time, but I appreciate the time that you've given. Thank you.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Brasco, you don't have one?
I do.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Marquardt.
So, thank you very much. And Superintendent Peterson, my question is, do you feel that by making these shifts, which are one-time funding type of things, will keep us in a permanent fiscal crisis, which in the long term could ultimately affect education funding a lot worse?
Superintendent Peterson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, I think I would look at it the other way. I think it helps us get out of a fiscal crisis. And I also am aware that as people look at the state of the state, that shift has to be recognized. I mean, the obligation of the state to pay that eventually has to be recognized. But we're all dealing with entities that hopefully will be here forever, the school districts and the state. So there are other people who could analyze that question perhaps better than I could, but I would suggest that it is not creating a crisis nor perpetuating a crisis. It's helping us avoid one.
Got that, Mark?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little concerned on how pushing things off later and using one-time funding, you did that in your school budget, how that actually helps strengthen your budget in the future. I don't understand. What do you mean by it actually would help you get out of this crisis?
Well,
in the long term. I don't quite understand that.
Madam Chair, obviously, running a state budget or running a school district budget for an organization of any size in our state is a complicated matter, and you use lots of tools. But if you go back to my basic point that if we're getting a benefit for this exchange, it makes sense to the school district. I would rather get $1.05 tomorrow than $1 today. That's the simple story. And I'll even pay you 50 cents interest in order to get that dollar. So I mean, it's a deal that you can't beat, as I said, for any school district in the state of Minnesota, even if you have to borrow all of the money to make the shift. So you use that tool, and I don't know that it's necessarily a one-time tool. I would suggest that maybe the state consider a shift to 86% and 14% for now, and maybe in the second year of the biennium go deeper. But the point is, you can use these shifts creatively for a number of years. And the problem we have is that some legislators saw fit to put this requirement in that we have to pay it back right away. That's the problem. We shouldn't have to unshift. We're not in any hurry to unshift the 90-10. We don't even care about that.
Well, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to move on to the next person so that we get equal time for all of them. But thank you both very much for coming, and sorry we didn't have more time.
Thank you.
Members, while Superintendent Brown is coming up, it's my thought, listening to Superintendent Peterson, that the shifts are kind of used as the rainy day fund. And if you don't pay them back, then you can't shift again in times of need. So, Superintendent Brown.
Madam Chair, Representatives, first of all, thank all of you for your support of public education in Minnesota. I'm going to give you a quick highlight about Grand Meadow and why that kind of fits in with what we're talking about today. Grand Meadow is a small rural school district located in southeastern Minnesota. We have 376 students, up from 21 students. We have 21 student gain in the last 2 years. Located 22 miles southwest of Rochester and 22 miles east of Austin. We operate in an energy-efficient dome school that was built 7 years ago. And we became the ninth QCOMP school in the state, the first small school to do QCOMP. We implemented all-day everyday kindergarten 3 years ago, expanded our preschool program, and we're one of the first high schools in the state to require 4 years of math and 4 years of science. Our buses leave at 7:30 in the morning. Our first kindergartners are picked up at 6:40. They're on a bus for an hour and a half We have the 19th lowest busing cost in the state, but we have long bus routes. During the 2006-2007 school year, Grand Meadow went into statutory operating debt. We ended the fiscal year with a negative unreserved general fund balance of $167,780, which was negative 4.64%. During the 2007-2008 fiscal year, every employee in our district took a voluntary pay freeze. We reduced expenditures everywhere possible and ended the year out of statutory operating debt in just 1 year. And then we had an unreserved balance on June 30th of $17,305. Our operating budget is $3,615,000. Our cash reserve that we had at the end of June 30th was equal to 7 hours. We would keep our school district going for 7 hours for 1 day. Our school board has established a goal of a cash reserve of 12%, or approximately $450,000. And as we prepared for the current fiscal year, Grand Meadow implemented a balanced approach of increasing revenue and decreasing expenses in order to balance our budget and start building our cash reserve. If you go to the second page, there's a list there of all the programs. We cut 11 jobs last summer. We impacted, obviously, 11 families. 11 people lost their jobs in Grand Meadow. And, you know, it tells you something about the state of school funding in Minnesota. When you have a school district that is the most energy-efficient district in the state, we have the 19th lowest busing costs, we're in a nice new building, we're growing in enrollment, and we have to cut $300,000 in order to balance this year's budget. We cut 11 jobs, eliminated our band program, our fax program. We cut a principal down to 0.2 FTE and put him back in the special ed classroom. We cut our career counselor, our Spanish program, one special ed teacher, three paraprofessionals, a half-time industrial tech ag teacher, and reduced our media center director. We cut $300,000. However, we also increased revenues. And I know that some of you might be thinking about that, and I hope you are. We increased revenues, we asked our voters, and we were the first district in 2008 to increase our operating levy from $853 per pupil to $1,200. That won by a landslide. 58% of the vote voted to increase their property tax levy at the local level. We increased student enrollment. That's obviously the best way to increase funding for the state is to increase your LOTMs. We increased athletic fees, we increased clubs and organization fees, we increased our lunch prices, we increased our breakfast prices, increase our milk prices. We also implemented QComp 3 years ago, which helps us a lot because it picked up $270 per pupil, and we established fees for non-required academic field trips. In addition to increasing revenues and decreasing expenses, however, Grand Meadow is also losing state revenue that was originally forecasted just a year ago. As some of you know, this is the year that the $60,000 for the wind energy production tax money is being taken away from our local district. That impacts over 30 districts now in the first congressional district. We are losing $100,000 in the fact that special education appropriations are capped, and because of the increased need of our children in Minnesota, we're not fully funding our commitment to special ed, and we're losing $100,000. Now, do the math real quick. We increased our operating levy, that picks up $139,000. We're losing $160,000. We have a cash reserve of $17,000. The really 20% shift, and I agree with Dr. Peterson to some extent in that if I had a choice between cuts and a shift, obviously we need to do our part, and I'm in favor of doing the shift over the cuts. However, I'm clearly on record of suggesting very strongly that Minnesota needs to increase revenue, and we need to look at income tax deductions, income tax credits, and property tax credits. I like the governor's plan, by the way, to decrease the corporate income taxes. I come from a state that has very, very low income taxes for corporations. I favor that. And just for the record, I want to go on record also saying that I support the governor's educational proposal almost down the line. I love the idea of expanding QComp statewide. I'm actually one of the first superintendents in the state that thought it was an interesting idea to do a pay-for-progress proposal. I call that QComp for kids. If you meet or exceed the state standards, you get 2% additional money on the formula. I think that's very creative, very innovative. I think it gives us as administrators a tool to encourage students and our staff and our parents to do a better job teaching our kids. And I love the idea of a summer of success proposal for 8th graders that haven't passed the MCA2s. We all know that we lose high school kids not in 11th or 12th grade. We lose them because they burped in 9th grade. All the research shows that. And if a student gets behind in credits in 9th grade and not going to graduate from their class, they tend to drop out of school. I love the idea of having a summer school program funded, I might add, for that. Anyway, I'll be glad to answer questions.
All right. Your last sentence there, though, it seems like it's a short-term solution to a long-term problem. Did you get that one in there?
I didn't. And I'll comment on that because I think Representative Garofalo, I think he's onto something here, too. I was at the governor's State of the State address. I thought he gave a marvelous speech at a tough time. But I thought he did really well. And, it's a tough job being governor right now of any state, especially here in Minnesota. But, we moved to Minnesota in 1993 with our 6 children because Minnesota was the best state in the nation to come to, and I still love the state. We're never leaving. But it's a different Minnesota today than it was in 1993. It's much different. And we are, it seems to me in the last 11 years, I think you can figure out the math on that. In the last 11 years, I think we've had leadership here that is very short-term, and we're not looking at the long-term benefit of Minnesota. We need to attract more people into Minnesota, and I think we're going to do that by having the best educational system in the country, and that means fully funding pre-K education all the way up through the college level, and that's what made Minnesota a great state, and that's what's going to continue us a great state. The fact of the matter is, I think this is a disaster waiting to happen. I think Representative Garofalo, you're onto something. By shifting, it's like, I just wrote a note. What in the world is going to happen in 2010-11? And what's going to happen in 2011-12? I met with my faculty the other day, and I shared with them my thoughts on this, and I shared with them the governor's proposals, and even though I'm very appreciative of the fact that we didn't take a hard, direct cut, we took some serious blows. Mm-hmm. And we all know that the proposal that's there, as modest as it is. But I hope and I pray that when you folks make your decisions at the end of the year, working collaboratively with the governor, that you'll come up with a proposal that increases significant revenues. And you're going to have to decrease the money.
Thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ken Brown, I'd like to ask about your operating levy referendum. Is that can you tell me, have you had others and successfully passed? And what would have been the implications of, obviously we know the implications had it not passed, but for districts that are, that are around the state that are having a tough time passing operating levy referendums, we still have major funding problems because of the discrepancy that it causes. So, can you give me some feedback on that and then relate that to how you feel about the Minnesota Miracle?
Thank you, Representative Ward. And Superintendent Brown, this is going to be the last. We won't have time for more questions because members, when he gets done, we're going to adjourn and hope that everybody in this room gets a chance to go to the House chamber and hear the early childhood presentation. But
Chairman Grayling, Representative, two great questions. First of all, Dead Meadow has a history of passing operating levies in the past. However, we tried to pass the levy referendum in November of 2007. And our neighboring districts, Leroy Ostrander and Southland, both passed levies of $1,400. They raised their levies to $1,400. And we had the same proposal. We were defeated that day. We came back. The advantage of being in statutory operating debt is you can do a levy anytime. And so we came back. We looked at April 1st. We decided that wasn't a good day. So we decided to move it back a week. We went to April 8th. And if you remember what happened to gas prices, on the following Tuesday, gasoline prices went up dramatically. We were fortunate that we got in on April 8th. And we had two questions. One was to raise to $1,200, one was to raise to $1,400. The $1,200 passed, the one to $1,400 failed. And because that failed, we had to cut deeper. That would have given us an additional $120,000. I got thinking about, if I could wave a magic wand short term, I would give school boards the authority. I would give school boards levy authority without a vote of the people, just like city councils and county commissioners have in Minnesota. I would give them levy authority up to $1,500 per student right now. that would bring in cash to the district, future cash, a year from now. But I would let them do it now on next year's tax payment. You know, the local taxpayer is going to be asked to invest. I was going to say something else. They're going to take it eventually anyway. Why don't we just do it up front and let school boards have the levy authority the same way city councils, mayors, and county commissioners have in Minnesota. You get away from the vote because, you know, people
okay,
have a chance
to
vote.
I'm going to have to stop right now, but you want to take 30 seconds for a second part of this question.
I went to two of the hearings for the Minnesota Miracle, one in Albert Lea and one in Faribault. I think you're on the right track with the Minnesota Miracle in many of the areas, in fact, in most of the areas. You know, obviously, we need to... The biggest concern we have in outstate Minnesota, the biggest complaint we always get is somebody else is getting more money than we are. And I have a little saying I carry with me, regardless of zip code. I think regardless of where our children live, and regardless of the type of children they are, they should have the same equal funding without a lot of special categoricals. And I think the Minnesota Miracle is 90% there.
That's a great ending point. Thank you all, and meeting adjourned. Go to the chamber, members.